All right, good morning, everybody. So I see that we have three lectures before the next exam. And I probably have four lectures worth of material. So I can't predict if I'm going to put it back after Thanksgiving yet or have it the day before Thanksgiving break. It's still too close a call. And I see we're just getting a little bit of a late start, so that means we're even a little bit more behind. So you got to come to class next week. So we're going to take two lectures next week, and we're going to see where we stand. Do we have two lectures next week? Oh, the 10th? Yeah, we got two lectures next week, and maybe we can finish up. Maybe, maybe not. Still too close to call. Sorry about that. That's the way it goes. I can't tell you yet. You have to come to class. Okay, so next week I'll know better. Of course, I'm sure we all would like to have it done sooner rather than later. All right, so let's get started. All right, so I've got this stuff working pretty well. I can work it with two hands. And we want to do lecture PowerPoints. Muscle. All right, now, let's see what happens when we go to slideshow mode. Oh, so much better. So much better. And then we'll do one-on-one. Turn some of these lights off. Like that. Maybe we'll have to leave it just like that. All right, so does anybody have any question on blood typing, for instance? What were the two main systems that we looked at? ABO and the RH system, right? And so where are you always going to find antigens? On the surface of the cell, plasma membrane. Okay, where are you going to find antibodies? They're going to be dissolved in plasma, right? So they are soluble, they go into the plasma. And what kind of reaction is the agglutination process? Well, at a molecular level, yeah, it's an antibody-antigen reaction. And then we moved into hemostasis, and that is what we call coagulation. So coagulation is different than agglutination. And there are two main processes for maintaining hemostasis. What were the two kinds of ways that your body can counteract the damage to a blood vessel? So one is fibrin formation, okay, and the other is, for small tears, platelet plug formation, right? So make sure you understand something about platelet activation versus fibrin formation. And so you should then, I guess, just relate fibrin formation with agglutination. Just like an antibody-antigen reaction, you should relate to what? Agglutination. All right, so what were we talking about last time? This figure right here. Okay, so on this figure, the important points on this figure here, here's the cursor. Let's see what I can do with this cursor. My cursor's going to fly away every time. Okay. Where is it at? Oh, it's in a different window someplace. Hold on, I lost it. Okay, it's stuck at the bottom of the page. How do we get it up? Come on, cursor. Here. Okay, that should do it. All right, so for the coagulation pathway, you've got extrinsic and intrinsic, and then you have a common pathway. But I want you to understand all of this in three main steps. The first step, prothrombin activator formation. That's factor 10. All right, so factor 10 becomes activated, and it will convert prothrombin. What can you tell me about prothrombin? Prothrombin is inactive, and it converts it into an active form, namely thrombin. And thrombin then is an enzyme, all right, that converts fibrinogen to fibrin. And again, fibrinogen is an inactive form, gets converted to the active form that forms a clot. Fibrin is an insoluble protein that forms that network of fibers that glues red blood cells and traps red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets all together to heal over injury to a blood vessel, right? And so these are the three main steps over here. And so what you see is a series of enzymatic reactions, and each enzymatic reaction acts as a level of what? Amplification. So this process happens very quickly, and when you have a series of steps of amplification, what do we call that? A cascade mechanism, right? So if you have a cascade mechanism with a series of steps of amplification, then this process can happen very, very rapidly. So that's really what I want you to take home from this particular slide. All right, the other thing is that I want you to know what some of these important little cofactors are, right? Like calcium is necessary for these factors to bind. And when they bind calcium, these factors go into the proper configuration, the proper shape, so that they have activity. Without calcium present, binding to some of these cofactors, then they don't take the proper shape, and as a result, they're inactive. And this clotting scheme just won't happen. The other important thing that you see right here that is a pathway that's not in your book, your book talks about it, and that is when thrombin becomes activated, it goes back and it activates factor 11, right? And then factor 11 joins the common pathway here, which then makes more fibrin. That makes more thrombin, which makes more fibrin. But when you have an increase in thrombin, because of this feedback loop right here, you get more factor 11 that's activated, which then makes more thrombin. What kind of feedback loop is that? It's a nice positive feedback loop, right? So that makes the process happen much more quickly as well. So not only do you have a cascade mechanism right here, you have positive feedback between the intrinsic and common pathways, which it greatly improves clotting function. As a matter of fact, your clotting function will be so reduced, right, without this positive feedback mechanism that essentially you won't have any clotting in your body. So this is very important. And this is the feedback mechanism that is adjusted when people take anticoagulation therapy with heparin. All right, so it blocks this positive feedback loop. Okay, so that's what I really want you to know. But I want you to know these three steps right here. All right, so when you analyze this diagram, think of it in terms of these three steps. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in the next couple of slides coming up, because it's really nice when you cut a blood vessel to have coagulation take place very rapidly, right, to stop bleeding, but you don't want coagulation to happen everywhere in your body, right? You just want coagulation, if you cut your finger, you don't want coagulation taking place in your little finger, right, and then your wrist, and then your forearm, then your arm, then your chest, and your brain, because, of course, that would be lethal, right? So there's got to be a mechanism to limit the extent of clot formation, and we're going to talk about that. And that process can go awry in certain patients where they have blood clots forming all over their body. That's called disseminated intravascular coagulation or coagulopathy. And you can imagine what that's like. That's terrible when that happens, when all of a sudden blood everywhere in somebody's body starts to coagulate, and that usually... there's usually not a very good outcome when that happens. Okay, so Some of these cofactors are enzymes, which means what? That it's a cascade mechanism. Don't forget, an enzyme doesn't get used up during the reaction, so that speeds up the rate of chemical reaction. Some of these things are cofactors. They have to be in your blood in order to have proper clotting function, like calcium. And also, you saw some phospholipids. Where would your body get phospholipids from?
Yeah.
From cell membranes, right? And when cell membranes get damaged, it releases phospholipids for the clotting function. So that makes perfect sense. All right, and then this is the bottom line for coagulation, which is what? Coagulation is? Yeah, it's fibrin formation. It's not an antibody antigen reaction, and fibrin is an insoluble protein that makes this network right here that traps platelets and red blood cells to seal over a rip in a blood vessel. All right, so this relates to your question, and maybe you were looking ahead and looking at these slides, okay? Or maybe that was just a good question that you came up with. Excellent. All right, so not only should you form clots very quickly, but when you don't need a clot there anymore, then it should be dissolved away. And this is also a system that limits the extent of coagulation inside your body, which is important because you don't want your whole body to coagulate. All right, when damage is repaired, activated factor 12 causes activation of an enzyme here called kallikrein. And kallikrein converts plasminogen. What can you tell me about plasminogen? It's inactive. It's everywhere in your body. It's in the blood at sufficient concentrations to become activated very quickly, and it's called plasmin. Plasmin digests fibrin. It dissolves a clot, and it also limits the extent of clot formation in your body so that your whole cardiovascular system doesn't fall into just one big blood clot. And sometimes in tissues, there's another compound called tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA. And you might be thinking, oh, gee, this is pretty interesting, because what happens if somebody has a heart attack or a stroke? Maybe they have a blood clot that's forming in their brain, cutting off blood supply to the brain. It would be good to maybe inject somebody with tissue plasminogen activator, activate this plasmin enzyme, and then that clot will dissolve away before the brain is damaged, right? And indeed, some people are using that clinically at some major hospitals. LA undergoes this kind of treatment, but you have to come up with a diagnosis first. Somebody can have a stroke for two main reasons. One is due to a clot in the brain, and one could be due to bleeding in the brain, maybe due to an aneurysm or a tumor that has become real fragile and there's bleeding in the brain. Both of those will cause a stroke, right? So you have to know which one is which, because if somebody has a bleed in the brain and you give them tissue plasminogen activator and the blood clot starts to dissolve, what's going to happen? Even worse bleeding, right? So instead of helping somebody, right, you've just made them a lot worse. So the diagnosis is real important before you institute any of these kinds of therapies. All right, so, and in some people they have too sensitive clotting mechanism, so they're on anticoagulation therapy. There are different agents that can be used as anticoagulants. For instance, we can use calcium chelators. You can't use this in a live person, because if you take calcium out of extracellular spaces, right, if you sequester calcium ions everywhere in the body, what's going to happen? Well, then they won't have synaptic transmission. They won't have muscle contraction, right? So you can't use things like EDTA or sodium citrate. But if you take a blood sample from somebody and you don't want it to clot in a test tube, then of course you can put these compounds within that test tube so that coagulation doesn't take place. So that would be in vitro. That's in a test tube. In vivo, both heparin and coumarin, right, can reduce clotting function. Heparin activates antithrombin 3, blocks thrombin formation. Coumarin blocks clotting by inhibiting activation of vitamin K. And vitamin K kind of works indirectly by reducing calcium availability to some of these cofactors so that they don't work properly. It just prevents the proper conformation of some of those cofactors to work properly. Okay, yeah, question.
Sorry, back to the question about stroke.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there specific symptoms, or do we actually have to go in and...
Oh, yeah, you have to do imaging studies to know. Okay, yeah. Because a stroke will kind of present itself clinically pretty much the same, whether it's due to bleeding or due to a thrombus in the brain. There's probably no way, there might be some people that can tell by inspection, but it's such a critical decision to make, you probably want some good hard evidence to know one way or the other. Okay? Okay, so you just can't just guess on that particular reason. Okay, pulmonary and systemic circulations. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two sides, right? It's got a left heart and a right heart. So how many major circulations are there in the body? There are two, right? There's a pulmonary and systemic circulation. And can you remember which one is larger? Which one is larger? Systemic. Here's a really good diagram. I don't know if I got this out of your book or the anatomy book, but you can see a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart is an artery, right? And you see some art, and so here is another artery, even though it's blue, okay? And that's because an artery just takes blood away from the heart. It doesn't really define what the state of the blood is in terms of oxygen and CO2. And you should then notice that the pulmonary circulation kind of is opposite in terms of its function compared to the systemic circulation. All right, so in the systemic circulation, arteries are high in oxygen or relatively high. In the pulmonary circulation, those arteries are relatively low in oxygen, and you should probably appreciate why that is. So make sure you know where all the valves are, all the pieces of the heart. And I see three kinds of blood vessels on this diagram. What are the three kinds of blood vessels? Arteries, and the definition of an artery is what? Just the direction of blood flow away from the heart. So we got arteries. What's another kind?
Vein.
So here is a vein. We can see, I can see arrows are what? Bringing blood back to the heart. That's a definition of a vein. And what's the third kind of blood vessel? You see what? Capillaries. I thought I heard coronaries. And coronaries can be arteries or veins. Okay. And capillaries are special because what happens in a capillary? Exchange can take place, right? And from your anatomy, you know exchange can take place through a capillary because they're thin, right? And exchange takes place mostly by diffusion. And diffusion only can happen over very short distances through thin spaces, thin membranes. So through simple squamous endothelium, that is the lining of a capillary, that's where exchange can take place or diffusion. So you got capillaries in the lungs for exchange, capillaries in the rest of your body for exchange as well. All right, so I think that's all we're going to talk about, but make sure you see. Oh, here's something, though, you should know something about, which we never did talk about in anatomy. Good thing I have it in red. Is it red or green? Who knows? Green? Okay, that's good. So it stands out nice and bright. Okay. So the heart is really two pumps back to back, right? And it's connected together at the interventricular septum and interatrial septum, but it's two pumps back to back. So that just means that the left ventricle pumps a certain amount of blood, and that has to match what the right ventricle is pumping, right? Because everything that the left ventricle pumps eventually finds its way to the right ventricle and is pumped through the pulmonary circulation. All right, so if the right and left ventricle don't match up exactly in terms of how much blood they're pumping, that means what's going to happen to blood someplace? All right, if the left ventricle is pumping a whole lot more than the right ventricle, what's going to happen? You're going to have blood backing up someplace in the systemic circulation. The systemic circulation, right, the volume is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, right, if the left ventricle is pumping more than the right ventricle, and then all of a sudden something's going to blow up, okay, because it can't stretch out. All right, so the rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. Maybe not from second to second, but over a period of just a few minutes. All right, so that's a point that we never made in anatomy. All right, and because the pulmonary circulation is so short, all right, compared to the systemic circulation, the left ventricle has to work 5 to 7 times greater compared to the right ventricle. And when you did your dissection, and even on this slide down over here, I can see the left ventricle wall, right, a lot thicker compared to the right ventricle wall as a result of that. So muscles respond to stress by getting stronger and bigger, okay? Kind of like our brains, kind of like our bones, kind of like just about everything in your body, right? And that's why people come up with that saying, use it or lose it. Okay, heart valves. Again, please review anatomy on your own, but how many chambers does a heart have?
Four.
How many valves does a heart have?
Four.
And they're into two major groups. What are the two major groups? Okay, the semilunar at the root of the pulmonary artery and at the root of the aorta. I don't see the aortic semilunar valve right here on this diagram, but you know it's in there, right? And what's the other major group? The atrioventricular, sometimes we call these the AV valves, right? So here is the pulmonary semilunar, aortic semilunar is here. Here are the atrioventricular valves, and the one on the right side of the heart is the tricuspid. The one on the left is the bicuspid, otherwise known as the mitral valve, and people use those two terms interchangeably in the same sentence. Okay, so review your cardiac anatomy. So we know these things. Be familiar with your cardiac, your papillary muscles and trabeculae carni, where are pectinate muscles. Okay. Here we see if we were to image the plane that all of the valves are in, all right, we notice that there is a fibrous myocardium. And the fibrous myocardium is not made of muscle cells. It's made out of connective tissue. And you know that muscle cells have voltage-gated channels, so they can conduct action potentials, but connective tissue doesn't have any kind of voltage-gated or ligand-gated channels. Connective tissue is not excitable like nerve or muscle tissue, so action potentials cannot move through the fibrous myocardium, and this fibrous myocardium is right at the junction between the atria and the ventricles. That's going to be important at the end of the chapter, okay, because the atria and the ventricles are not directly electrically connected to each other because of this fibrous myocardium that acts as insulation between the chambers. The other nice thing that I see on this diagram, which I wish was in the anatomy book, I'll have to remember that it's in this diagram. Here is, what's the most anterior great vessel coming off the base of the heart? That's a pulmonary trunk, right? So here's the pulmonary trunk coming off here. Then posterior to that is the aorta, right? So here we see the pulmonary semilunar valve and the aorta. So you just got to trust me, this is the aorta coming out. And I see two important blood vessels. This is kind of, I think, an important review for you. Okay. And I see two blood vessels coming off the ascending aorta right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve. And can anybody recognize these blood vessels right here? It's red, right? So these are, yeah, so these are the coronary arteries, right? So don't forget the first branch is off the aorta, not the brachiocephalic, but actually the right and left coronary arteries. So this would be the left coronary, here would be the right coronary artery. Okay. Cardiac cycle. All right, so I got to get to work talking about this one. I just can't say review this on your own because we never talk about this stuff in anatomy yet. But the cardiac cycle has to deal with the nature of the heart as a pump. Okay, you have various pumps at home that you just plug into the wall and you turn the pump on and it pumps continuously. Now the heart is a pump, but it doesn't pump blood continuously. It's what we call a reciprocating pump. That means that sometimes it's pumping blood and there are other times when it's not pumping blood, and those times when it's not pumping, blood is actually flowing in so that when the heart does contract, all right, it can actually pump some blood. So there are two main phases to the cardiac cycle. Systole refers to the contraction phase. That's actually when the heart is contracting. And most of that time when the heart is contracting, it's pumping blood. There's a little piece of time when it's contracting and no blood is being pumped. Okay, but systole refers to the contraction phase. Diastole refers to the relaxation phase. And you probably have a pretty good sense of that, because, for instance, when you get your blood pressure checked, and probably everybody's had their blood pressure checked, how many numbers do they give you? At least in Western medicine, right, they give you two numbers, right? For instance, like 120 over 80. 120 refers to the peak pressure or the systolic pressure. 80 refers to the low pressure right before the heart starts to contract again. We call that the diastolic pressure. Okay? So those are the two main important parts of the cardiac cycle. And the cardiac cycle, or when the heart starts to pump, both atria contract together, followed by the ventricles a little bit later, maybe like 200 milliseconds later, 250 milliseconds later, the ventricles contract. All right, so we said that way back when we looked at cardiac muscle tissue, that there are special junctions between the cells, so that if only one myocardial cell depolarizes, what happens to the rest of the myocardial cells? They will follow along because they have what kind of proteins between cells? They have gap junctions between them. So when sodium enters a cell in one cell, sodium then will flow into a neighboring cell through those gap junctions. And what do we call it when sodium enters a cell? What happens to the membrane potential? It depolarizes, and what kind of event is that? That's excitatory, right? Because that, as long as those cells have voltage-gated channels, when depolarization reaches a certain threshold, then you have an action potential, and that initiates muscle contraction through that excitation-contraction coupling mechanism that we talked about. All right, so you're familiar with your systemic blood pressure because we measure blood pressure using like the brachial artery. But you have another circulation inside your body. What's that called? Okay, besides your systemic circulation, you have the, you got the pulmonary circulation. And where are all those blood vessels? Do you have those? Do you have any pulmonary vessels out in your arms or fingertips or legs or earlobe or anything where it's easy to measure the pressure in that part of your body? No, the pulmonary blood vessels are deep inside your thoracic cavity. Virtually impossible to measure, right, without some kind of surgical procedure. All right, so what you should know about that is that the pulmonary pressure is a lot lower. It's only 25, probably maximum, maybe not even 25 millimeters of mercury, over 10. So this is the systolic, this is diastolic. And there's a condition called hypertension, right? And you can have systemic hypertension, so anything over 120 over 80 right here would be hypertension. And is that a fairly common disease? Yeah, absolutely. And some of the effects of that is that that will eventually kill your kidneys, cause peripheral vascular disease, it damages all blood vessels in your body, including blood vessels that supply blood not just to the kidney but to your brain and heart, right, and retina. So hypertension is a very serious disease, and we're familiar with that. But since we can't really measure pulmonary blood pressure, right, that's just part of a disease process that we know very little about, but it's just as serious or even more serious than systemic hypertension. And I think I'll maybe talk about that sometime during the class, right? Pulmonary hypertension as opposed to systemic hypertension. All right, let's look at some of these important terms, some definitions of the cardiac cycle. End-diastolic volume. That's the volume of a ventricle, the volume of blood in the ventricle at the end of diastole. What's diastole again? That's relaxation. And what happens during relaxation? Does the heart pump blood, or does the heart just sit there and get filled up? It sits there and it gets filled up. Right? And for a long time, people weren't really interested in diastolic function of the heart. They were interested in the systolic function of the heart, which is what? When it is pumping blood. Okay, so, and systolic volume is the volume of a ventricle, or how much blood is left in a ventricle after contraction. Right? So at the end of systole. And that makes perfect sense that people were really interested in this figure or this term or this concept much more earlier on than end-diastolic volume, because if the heart is not pumping blood, okay, then you don't have blood pressure, and it produces a lot of problems for people, like syncope. What is syncope? Like fainting. Yeah, fainting, right? So we don't want people fainting, especially when they're driving on the same street as we are, right? Okay. Okay, so which volume is larger, end systolic volume or end diastolic volume? So you kind of have to think about this. Under which phase, in which phase is the heart filling up? Diastole, the diastolic phase. So as the heart's filling up, the heart chamber is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? So end diastolic volume, okay, is the larger volume. And end systolic volume, that's right after the heart is contracting, that should be the smallest volume that you see within a ventricle. So I don't know if that's really intuitive to see that or not. But here's something that's not really intuitive, but people are becoming really interested, right? And in order for the heart to fill up during diastole, the heart has to relax. So if the heart doesn't relax during diastole, guess what's going to happen? It won't fill up with blood, okay? And that might not seem like too bad a deal, but if the heart's not filled up with blood by the time systole occurs, guess what? The heart can't pump any blood or pumps very little. So your blood pressure is going to drop, you'll have decreased perfusion, you can go into shock. So diastolic function of the heart is just as important to understand as systolic function of the heart. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time, but you'll be aware of that as we go through our discussions. And stroke volume right here is just the difference between these two volumes, and it is the amount of blood that is pumped out of the heart every time it contracts. Okay, and since end systolic volume is not zero, it just means that there's always going to be some blood left in the ventricle after it contracts. It's not possible for the ventricle to pump out every little bit, every drop of blood that's in there. There's always going to be some residual volume. So make sure that you can calculate stroke volume. So here I say end systolic volume is 20, end diastolic volume is 80. What is going to be the stroke volume? That's exactly how you would. So don't forget, EDV is greater, right? ESV is smaller, so in this particular case, 60 mLs would be a good answer for that one. Okay. Let's look at a figure to talk about some of these things like isovolumetric contraction, isovolumetric relaxation, atrial systole versus ventricular systole. And in order to do that, I need to come over here. I need to come over here and do something like this. But let's do this. Okay, so here's a Wiggers diagram. And it just shows a number of cardiac parameters plotted out versus time. And this is a figure that you have in your lab manual. I don't know if you got to this lab yet, but you'll get to this sooner or later. I've modified it just a little bit, okay, because what did I do? Oh, I did something really bad. Really, really bad. All right, I filled in the correct answers right here, okay, because it can be a little confusing, but I want you to really understand this diagram, okay, and then I added a couple other things right here, like the end systolic volume and end diastolic volume. So what the heck are we looking at? Let's see, maybe it's shown just, I have to shrink it maybe just a little bit. Oh, that's right, that button doesn't work. This button works. Ah, this is a little bit better. All right, so this is a plot of a number of physiologic parameters versus time. So here is the time axis right here, and then this little O represent, that's not a zero, that's an O. That's a conceptual term that you'll have to match up with this, right, with this word bank right over here. But then we have time in seconds, right, starting at zero, then 200 milliseconds, 400 milliseconds, 6, and 800 milliseconds. And these physiologic parameters are going to be blood pressure versus what? Blood pressure versus time, okay? And then we're going to look at ventricular volume versus time. And then we're going to look at electrical activity on the surface of your body. And we call this electrocardiogram, and that can be spelled with a K or a C, ECG or EKG, versus what? Time. And I think you've done ECGs in lab already. Did you do ECGs in lab already? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And then the fourth parameter right here is just going to be sounds, heart sounds versus time. And these are all plotted out right? So that they're all justified, so that they're all correctly happening in the same period of time. So that we can compare pressure within various parts of the heart against volume and compare that when the ECG is actually happening, so that we can understand something about the heart cycle, the cardiac cycle. All right, so what are the two main parts of the cardiac cycle? Systole and diastole, right? When it's contracting, so here is systole, and then the rest of the time is diastole. All right, so we can look at, when is pressure generated, during systole or diastole? During systole, right? All right, so let's look at a pressure curve to see if indeed that is the case. And let's look at the pressure inside of a ventricle. So let's start down here at zero during diastole when the heart is not contracting. I see a little blip right here, all right, but the major part, all right, the major increase in blood pressure inside the ventricle happens during systole. When the heart starts to contract, we see a rapid rise in blood pressure. All right, so I'm trying to trace the curve of ventricular pressure. All right, and then the heart goes into diastole, and look what happens. The pressure goes down. All right, we see that the pressure increases in the ventricle before it starts to contract, because the atria actually contract before the ventricles. And so when the atria contract, it forces a little bit of extra blood inside the ventricles, so the pressure inside the ventricles goes up just a little bit as a result of that. Okay. And then the dotted line right here represents pressure inside the aorta. So this is an artery that's leaving the heart. And notice that the pressure inside the aorta never drops to zero. So what's the minimum pressure in the aorta according to this graph right here? What's the minimum pressure? So here's pressure inside the aorta, 80. All right, so that would be a good diastolic pressure. And what's the maximum pressure inside the aorta? 120, and we said that was the normal blood pressure, right? 120 over 80. So does that sort of make sense? Yeah, it should for you. Okay. Now, I see another pressure right down through here. This is, I hope this is atrial pressure. Okay, so here is atrial pressure. So how is blood going to flow? And you can rely upon how something diffuses. How does something diffuse from one place to another? It's by concentration, right? But it's a concentration what? Gradient. There's got to be a difference in concentration. So how is something going to diffuse? By concentration gradient. From low to high or high to low? It's always going to be from high to low. And a fluid is going to flow due to a pressure difference. All right? And how is something going to flow according to a pressure difference? From high to low or low to high? From high to low, just like for diffusion, right? It's just going to be from high to low. So here we see, right, the pressure curve in an atria, and I can see that it increases when the atria start to contract, and the pressure in the atrium is higher than the ventricle, so guess what's going to happen to blood when the pressure in the atrium is higher than the ventricle? Which way is blood going to flow? It's going to flow from the atrium into the ventricle, right, because the pressure in the ventricle is so low. But when the ventricle starts to contract, all right, what happens to the pressure in the ventricle? It starts to skyrocket, and it crosses over. It's greater than the atria. So what about this blood in the ventricle? Will it go back into the atrium? It can't. Oh, that's a really good thing. Because what's stopping it? What's preventing blood from a ventricle from going back into this atrium right here? There's a valve. And what valve in particular is that? Yeah, that's the atrioventricular valve. It could be on the right or left side of the heart, but let's confine our discussion here to the left side of the heart. So that would be the bicuspid valve closes. And when the bicuspid valve actually blood starts to flow back into the atrium, but that closes the valve, right? So it can't flow back. And when that AV valve closes, guess what it makes? A huge sound, a huge noise. So here is the heart sound. All right, so the first heart sound in the cardiac cycle is due to what? Closure of the AV valves. And when does that happen? Right at the beginning of ventricular systole. So that's a pretty cool diagram to see that. Okay? All right, and now the pressure is here's the pressure in the aorta, right? So the pressure in the ventricle is less than in the aorta, so blood can't flow from a ventricle into the aorta until it gets what? Greater than the pressure in the aorta. And so then it will start to flow into the aorta, but there's usually something that prevents blood flow across the aorta, in or out of the ventricle. There's a semilunar valve right there. Yeah, fantastic, all right? But when the pressure inside the ventricle is greater than the aorta, like right here, then the semilunar valve's open. And blood can flow out of the ventricle into the aorta, and when it flows into the aorta, what happens to the pressure in the aorta? It starts to rise, right? Okay, and then the ventricles, right, they don't start to relax, but this is just a big ejection phase of blood, and so the ventricles kind of run out of blood that they can pump since it's going into the aorta. It's still contracting, but there's not very much blood left in the ventricle. So the pressure starts to decrease, okay? And now the pressure inside the ventricle is lower than inside the aorta. How come blood doesn't flow from the aorta back into the ventricle right here? Then the semilunar valves slam closed, right? And when they slam closed, that produces the second heart sound down over here. All right, so the first heart sound is closure of the AV valves. The second heart sound is closure of the semilunar valves. And you can see that on this diagram. Now you see a little funny thing happening right here, right? You see a little transient drop in blood pressure in the aorta, and then it rises really fast. What's that due to? Well, it takes a little energy, right? It takes a little pressure in the aorta to actually close the semilunar valves. When it flows backward just a little bit to inflate those valve cusps, and we call that the dicrotic notch. So in an accurate diagram, you would see that in every particular case. So all the blood that was in the, that got ejected from the ventricle ends up in the aorta, right? And then very slowly during diastole, the pressure starts to decrease in the aorta. Until which time? When the ventricles contract once again, then it goes back up to systolic pressure, right? And then it dies back down to diastolic pressure. All right, so don't forget, down here is atrial pressure, and we see atrial pressure increasing slightly, okay, when the ventricles contract, and then when the ventricles start to relax, the pressure goes down, and then it slowly rises again as it fills up with blood. And then there's a kind of a little jump in blood pressure in the atria when the atria contract, right, as they're pumping blood into the ventricles. All right, so make sure you see these pressure curves. Let's relate that to a volume curve. All right, so what happens during diastole? And here's diastole over here before systole. So this is diastole. What's happening during diastole in the ventricle? As a matter of fact, let's start at the beginning of diastole. Okay, the ventricles relax and they start to fill up with blood. Okay, so what happens to the volume of a ventricle when it fills up with blood? It gets larger, right? And then, right here, the atria contract. What happens to the volume of a ventricle when the atria contracts? It bumps up a little bit more, right? Okay, and so here we see the bump up due to the contraction of the atria. This is the end of diastole, so we're going to call this what? The end diastolic volume. Okay, end diastolic volume. And we said what? End diastolic volume is greater than end systolic volume. And here on this chart, you can see that very nicely. Okay. So here between these two little lines right here, the ventricle is contracting and we can see the pressure rising. But at this point in time, the atrioventricular valve is closed and the semilunar valve is closed because it doesn't open up until this point right here. Right, so all the valves to the ventricular chamber is closed. So what can happen to the volume when all the valves to a ventricle is closed? If nothing can enter, if nothing can leave, what about the volume? It stays the same, right? The pressure increases, but blood is a non-compressible kind of tissue. It can't shrink down, okay? So this is what we call isovolumetric contraction. Isovolumetric contraction happens when the AV valve is closed and the semilunar valves are closed, But the heart is still contracting nonetheless during this period of time right here. Isovolumetric contraction. All right, there is another period of time that's called isovolumetric relaxation in the heart. And that's the period of time when the semilunar valve is closed and again when the atrial ventricular valve is closed. That's this period of time. So between 4 and 5, what can you tell me about the volume of the ventricle? Is it changing right here? No blood can enter or leave, so this is what we call isovolumetric relaxation. Again, when the semilunar and AV valves are closed during this period of time. Isovolumetric, the volume is not changing. Okay, so you see how these heart sounds relate to the opening and closing of various valves. The only thing I didn't go over is this region right here. All right, and so this shows the intersection of pressure in the ventricle and pressure in the aorta. So here we have pressure in the ventricle that is still higher than the atria. Where is blood going to want to go in this region right here? If it's high in the ventricle and low in the atria, which way is blood going to want to go? From the ventricle, from high to low, from the ventricle into the atrium, but can it? Because of the atrial ventricular valve, right, is closed. But right over here, all right, right in this region right here, now you have low pressure in the ventricle compared to high pressure in the atria. So what happens right at this intersection right here? This is where the AV valve opens, and blood can now flow from this atrium into the ventricle right at this location. And when it flows into a ventricle, right, then you have filling of the ventricles as a result of opening of the AV valve. All right, the last thing that we didn't talk about, which is probably the next part of this chapter, is the electrocardiogram. All right, and I think I'm going to come back to that in just a little bit. So I'm going to go back to, all right, who's got a question about this? Maybe you're so confused at the moment you don't even have a question, okay? But nonetheless, you got to look at that figure. No, it's like this. Okay, you got to look at that figure because I'm sure that's going to be a quiz in lab somewhere along the line. Oh, plus it's an exam figure, okay? Should I go back to that figure? Oh, that would be cool. Oh, that's a pretty nice diagram. Yeah? Okay, you want to go over that with this diagram right here? Okay. So, you just have to remember that blood is going to flow from high pressure to low. Okay? And so in this region right here, there's high blood pressure in an atrium and low blood pressure in the ventricle. So the AV valve is opened. As soon as pressure in the ventricle gets higher than pressure in the atrium, then that AV valve is going to close. All right? And so maybe, and all these graphs that you look at are just off just a slight little bit. Okay, so the crossover should probably be right here. And is that where it is on your diagram? It's close. It's close. All right. But this one here is really nice, right, because this just shows that the semilunar valve opens right here because the pressure in the ventricle is greater than pressure inside the aorta. So that's nice. All right, but if I were going to draw this figure, I'd probably move this intersection over just a little bit to the left. Okay, because isovolumetric contraction can't really happen until that AV valve closes. And that should be right on line number one right here. Okay, but it's close. As a matter of fact, this is the best diagram I've ever seen. Okay, say that again. Well, these are just graphs, right? Graphs of various physiologic parameters versus time. All right, so if you want to measure pressure, then you have to have a pressure transducer in somebody's left ventricle and aorta and atrium right here. So these are real events that are happening inside somebody's heart and inside somebody's aorta. you can kind of understand this aorta curve a little bit when you monitor somebody's blood pressure with a blood pressure cuff, but you can't draw a curve like that. You only get 2 points. So when you measure somebody's blood pressure with a cuff, you only get the systolic pressure and diastolic pressure. You can't view this whole curve right here. And in some forms of medicine, understanding what the waveform looks like is very important. Like in traditional Chinese medicine, right? They just don't go by the peak pressure and the systolic pressure and diastolic pressure, but there are practitioners that actually palpate. They put their fingertips on various parts of the body and they get an impression of what the waveform actually looks like. All right, and they come up with a diagnosis just like that. And as a matter of fact, there are Chinese doctors that are blind, and they don't use, all right, numbers to come up with a diagnosis. They do what? By palpation, by feeling what somebody's pressure waveforms look like. All right, but that's not important in Western medicine yet, but maybe someday it will be. Okay, or it's okay to have two different systems of practicing, or three different kinds of systems of practicing medicine. Okay. All right, so the important things on this diagram right here is, number one, the cursor. Ah, here it is. The cursor. Make sure, first, just make sure you know that this is pressure versus time. Here is volume versus time. All right, and then here are just sounds that come from your heart versus time. And then start to relate one to the other. But here was what? End diastolic volume and end systolic volume. And opening and closing of these valves is pretty easy to understand as long as you realize that fluid is going to want to flow from where to where? From high pressure to low pressure. And that you can see with the intersections of these lines and the pressure curves. And so these intersections right here have to do with opening and closing of the AV valves, right? Because here's an atrial pressure curve and a ventricular pressure curve. While the intersection of these two lines represent what? Closure of the semilunar valves, because this is the aortic pressure and ventricular pressure intersection. Okay? All right, so that's a good way to start with this. And if you want to come talk to me about that during office hours, that's great. All right, so we talked about this slide completely already. And I think you have another slide in your book. What happens if I do this? And then do this. Ah. All right, so this is maybe the figure that you have in your textbook, right, which is pretty good. It's not too bad. It's not quite as accurate as the one that's in your lab manual. All right, so you got electrocardiogram, phonocardiogram, and various pressures and volume curves, but it's basically the same one. All right, the heart sounds we talked about already, heart murmurs. All right, heart murmurs, important diagnostic tool. All right, so we listen to heart sounds, and sometimes you hear extra sounds coming from the heart. All right, and they represent abnormal patterns of blood flow through the heart. All right, so some of these defects are caused by defective heart valves, and defective heart valves can be congenital in origin, which means what? You're born with them, and sometimes they're developmental. They develop during a person's lifetime, right? Maybe due to viral infection, and sometimes we don't even know where this virus came from, and sometimes it can be due to bacterial infections. It can damage a heart valve so that they don't open properly or don't close properly anymore. And when a valve doesn't work properly, generally, that means that's going to kill the heart, because the heart has to work much harder to pump blood through the pulmonary circulation or a systemic circulation. Think of it as walking up or running up a sand dunes. All right, first, think about running up these stairs right here. Is that a lot of work? Yeah, that's going to be a lot of work. Now, just make it worse by taking these stairs away and put a sand dunes right here. Now, run up the sand dunes. What is that going to be like? That's going to be really, really hard. Why is that? Because every time you take a step up, what happens? You slide down half a step, and then you got to take another step up, and then you slide down. So the amount of work, right, is just tremendous. So if a heart has a leaky valve, it's pumping. It's like running uphill. But when the heart goes into relaxation, what happens to that blood? It slides back into a ventricle. That's like sliding down a sand dune. All right, so what would it be like for you to run up a sand dune all day long? What's going to happen? Well, you're going to croak, right? There's just no way to do that. So what's going to happen to your heart if it has to pump blood that's going to slide backwards, right, day in and day out, minute after minute after minute? It's just going to run out of energy as well, right? So that's asking way too much for the heart. So then those valves have to be repaired or replaced. All right, so if it's not congenital, it's developmental, like maybe as a result of rheumatic fever, when your body produces antibodies to kill the streptococcus infection, some of those antibodies cross-react with heart tissue. All right, so not only can you fight the streptococcus infection, then you're producing an autoimmune disease where your own immune system then attacks valves. And okay, there's a streptococcus kind of infection by mutans and lactobacilli, which causes dental cavities or dental caries. And somebody thought, well, gee whiz, since the dental caries or cavities are produced by bacteria, we can produce a vaccine against dental disease, and nobody's ever going to have dental disease anymore. And so they came up with a nice vaccine where a person actually never progressed far enough into people, but in animal models, right, it produced a very nice immunity against dental caries because these bacteria couldn't grow in the mouths of animals, right? But then it was quickly realized that after that vaccine, then people built up immunity to their, or these animals built up immunity to their own heart. So the vaccine produced antibodies that killed the hearts of those animals, so it never progressed to human trials, which is a really good thing, right? So I'd much rather have a heart and dental caries than not having dental caries and no heart, right? And that's because the shape of those antigens were so similar that the antibodies, right, cross-reacted between heart tissue and those bacteria. Okay. So what are the kinds of problems that people can have with valves? There can be stenotic valves. And a stenotic valve is a valve that doesn't open completely. All right, so if a valve doesn't open completely, then blood can't flow from an atrium into a ventricle when that happens. All right, so so if that ventricle can't fill with blood, when it contracts, it's not going to be able to pump any blood. So that's a huge problem. So an accumulation of blood in the left atrium can cause pulmonary hypertension. Right, and pulmonary hypertension will destroy the right side of the heart, the right ventricle, and it will destroy the lung when pressure builds up because the pulmonary circulation is used to what? Very low pressures, not high pressures. So in this particular case, what would a person need if the lung is destroyed and the right side of the heart is destroyed? Well, then they need a heart and lung transplant, right, which is a huge problem. All right, so that's why just a simple diagnostic test just by to listen to heart sounds, right, can prevent a lot of agony in people. All right, so that's what we call stenosis. But sometimes valves open properly, but they don't close properly, right? And that's what we call an incompetent or an insufficient valve if it doesn't close, right? And if it doesn't close, and that could be due to malformation of the valve leaflets or due to papillary muscles that aren't functioning properly, then the heart has to work way too hard to pump blood, and eventually it's going to die as a result of that. So insufficient or incompetent valves cause problems for the heart. There are other kinds of sounds that the heart can make due to other kinds of problems, right? These are due to septal defects. And remember, a septum is just something that separates out a couple cavities inside the heart, like there's a septum between the ventricles, there's a septum between the atria. And remember your fetal circulation. When you're a fetus, do you need to send blood to the lungs to become oxygenated? Are you using your lungs as a fetus?
No.
Okay, no, because you're getting oxygen via the placenta from your mom. All right, so in the fetus, there is a hole in the heart called the what? Okay. The foramen ovale, which is close. Foramen. Now, foramen is a patent open hole, right, between the right atrium and left atrium right here, so that when blood is returned to the right atrium, it flows into the left atrium, bypassing the pulmonary circulation, and so that just spares a lot of energy for the fetal heart. And as soon as you're born, that foramen ovale closes over and it becomes the fossa ovalis, right? Becomes the fossa ovalis. But in a certain number of our population, it doesn't close completely. So even after you're born, blood moves from the right atrium into the left atrium, bypassing the lungs. But then you don't have a placenta oxygenating your blood anymore. And so then how are you born? What's an obvious sign? Yeah, blue baby, a cyanotic baby, right? Because you don't have oxygenated blood coursing through your systemic circulation. So that's one possible reason that somebody's born cyanotic. And then that patent foramen ovale, that's what a PFO is, patent foramen ovale, right? Patent just means that it's still open. If a blood vessel is patent, guess what? Blood can flow through it. If a foramen is patent, that means that it is still a passageway between a couple of places. All right, then that has to be repaired. And as a matter of fact, you can have a small patent foramen ovale, and some people, it's not diagnosed until maybe when they're 40 years old, maybe even 50 years old, before they go into heart failure. All right, so there might be some of us in here that still have a minor patent foramen ovale. And fortunately now, there are methods of repairing that foramen, right, that can be done endoscopically, which means that instruments can be threaded through a saphenous vein into this inferior vena cava, and they can close that hole without opening up somebody's chest and opening somebody's heart up. All right, so that's really almost like a same-day procedure where they kick you out of the hospital almost the same day. I'm not sure. Okay. Question? Well, then they're put on oxygen right away. Okay, that would be a nice simple thing to do first. Then somebody has to diagnose exactly what is producing that condition. Here is one particular example. Maybe they have a patent foramen ovale, but what else? Maybe there's something wrong with their lungs, or maybe there is a transposition of the pulmonary artery with the aorta right here. Maybe the connection of these blood vessels hasn't connected to the heart properly. So yeah, that's kind of a big problem, right? But people specialize in coming up with that diagnosis very quickly, doing ultrasound studies, maybe MRI imaging studies, to find out what's wrong with the anatomy of the heart and the great vessels off the heart, and then it's got to be corrected surgically very quickly. Yeah, because you can't live very long like that, right? All right, so that's the patent foramen ovale if you have a hole in the interatrial septum. But sometimes somebody's going to have a hole in the interventricular septum, okay? And it's going to make a racket as well. And on MRI and ultrasound studies, you can see just big jets of blood squirting from the left ventricle into the right ventricle. And it's always going to be that way. Why is blood always going to squirt from the left ventricle to right ventricle, just as illustrated right here? Ah, exactly right, right? That's a good critical thinking kind of question, because the left ventricle is always producing higher pressure to pump blood through the systemic circulation compared to the right ventricle that only has to generate a maximum of 25 millimeters of mercury versus what over here? What's the maximum pressure in the left ventricle under normal circumstances? Yeah, it's 100 millimeters of mercury greater, right? So it's like 120. Okay, so those would be septal defects. All those make different kinds of sounds in times of the heart cycle, right, that don't correspond to the first heart sound and second heart sound. All right, so we only got to electrical activity of the heart today. All right, which is where we're going to have to start next time, electrical activity of the heart. But don't forget your membrane channel. Any of your membrane channels, because that's going to be important for understanding autorhythmicity and some properties of the heart, like, for instance, skeletal muscle can go into tetany, right? You can get a Charlie horse, well, skeletal muscle goes into tetany, which hurts really bad, but it's not going to kill you. But if your heart goes into tetany, that's going to kill you. But fortunately, thank you so much. Here's a sign-in sheet. Here's another sign-in sheet. Good, I'll just staple them together. Fortunately, the heart cannot go into tetany, and you're going to have to know why. So you can read ahead a little bit and find out why the heart can't go into tetany. It has special membrane channels that prevent tetanus in the heart.